It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here's another expression of the law of supply and demand. When the global economy declined, the price of gas went down. Now that the economy is growing, the price of gas is rising again.
And we may have to get used to the prices we have now, over $4 per gallon in some parts of the country. The Energy Department says it is likely to stay around $4 through the summer. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Gas prices are expected to be nearly 40% higher this summer compared to last year. And the higher prices are not going unnoticed at the Stan Hadoff's discount gas station in Boston.
It's not good for the people. This is very bad.
Omeri Velagosti is filling up his car. He works doing a little food delivery for his son's family restaurant. And Velagosti says he's been making at least some changes in response to the rising gas prices.
I go for shopping or just for coffee, less than before.
Oh, you mean just to save the money on the coffee, is that because you need to spend more on gas kind of thing?
Yes, for the gas is the problem.
This is a big question that economists are trying to figure out right now. How much will rising gas prices hurt consumer confidence and consumer spending?
Every weekend is like, nope, money for gas, not, you know, personal items.
At the next pump over, Nancy Morales and her husband Luis are putting $50 in their old Jeep Cherokee. They run a small house cleaning business, and they've got their son in the back seat. And the family says they've been cutting back a bit, too.
Yeah, we wanted to go to the fair. We wanted to go to Bonkers this weekend, and we have to put the price of Bonkers and the price of gas. Like, if we're going to put gas in the car.
What's Bonkers?
Bonkers is like an indoor park, like a Chuck E. Cheese.
Of course, blowing a little less money on pizza and video games probably is not going to drag the whole economy down. But if hundreds of millions of people all start cutting back in significant ways, that could add up to big problems. Peter Morisi is an economist at the University of Maryland.
Whenever we pay more for gas, dollars leave the country to pay for imported oil. That's money that could be spent on U.S. products, and in turn, it slows demand, slows growth, and jobs creation.
So the economy's been doing better recently. The unemployment picture's improving. But Morisi says rising gas prices will slow that growth and might even stop it.
I can't predict recessions any better than anyone else. But I do know rising gasoline prices in a country that imports 10 million barrels a day is very detrimental to economic growth and can seriously threaten the recovery.
Still, other economists are much less concerned. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at the forecasting firm IHS.
At this juncture, the increase in gasoline prices, even to above $4 a gallon, is not a huge deal. Clearly, it is squeezing some households, especially lower-income households. But it's very different than what happened, let's say, in 2008 when the economy was already in recession.
Back then, gas prices also hit $4 a gallon, and the country was just sliding into a historic financial crisis. Now, the Federal Reserve says the economic recovery is, quote, on firmer footing, so things seem to be in better shape. And Baravesh says at the end of the day, most Americans really don't spend that much money on gas.
Average households spend about 5% of their after-tax income on gasoline. That has risen a little bit from about 2%. A couple of years ago when oil prices and gasoline prices collapsed. So it is higher, but it's not a killer. This is not something that's going to kill this recovery.
Baravesh says everybody is very aware of gas prices. You have to stand there watching the cost tick up slowly as your tank fills and your wallet empties. Same thing for some very visible food items. Prices are up for milk and beef. But overall, Baravesh says inflation has been very mild for all kinds of other things. Flat panel TVs, refrigerators, haircuts. Still, that said, he does not want to see gas prices rise much further. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama is wading into a debate that he avoided until today. In a speech later this afternoon, he will offer a long-range plan for reducing the federal debt. It was the president who last year formed a commission to look into the debt. But this year, fiscal experts say the president's own budget proposal did relatively little to deal with the long-term problem. Joining us to preview the president's speech is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, why is the president giving this speech at this moment in time?
Well, the White House says this was their plan all along. They say as soon as the budget debate was done last week and Paul Ryan, the House Republican Budget Committee chair, had put his deficit plan forward and before the debt ceiling debate heated up, they would go forward. Now, there's no doubt, as you said, that the president has taken some hits for not leading on the big fiscal issues. But the White House believes that waiting was worth it because the Ryan budget, with its deep spending cuts, big tax cuts for the wealthy, and privatizing Medicare, has opened up a huge space in the political center, and they want the president to occupy that space.
And what does the White House, well, they want him to occupy the space, but what exactly do they want to accomplish with this speech?
Well, I think the political goals for this speech is that the president wants voters to believe that he has a serious plan for dealing with the deficit. He wants to convince them that it's better and fairer than the Ryan plan. And also, he wants to remind them that he wants to work across the aisle with Republicans, just like he did in the lame duck tax negotiations and last week on the budget negotiations, to solve this problem.
How specific will the president get?
Well, I think the big news from this speech is going to be that he will embrace much of the recommendations of his own Deficit Reduction Commission. The White House guidance this morning says he'll be borrowing from it. This is the Bowles-Simpson plan that he has kept at arm's length until now. It's the plan that that bipartisan group called the Gang of Six in the Senate is trying to figure out a way to legislate. The commission's goals are to reduce spending in every area, military, domestic, Medicare, Medicaid, and to overhaul the tax code so you lower income tax rates across the board by ending or shrinking a lot of tax breaks. And I think you'll hear the president say today that this is the foundation for going forward. It's the best opportunity for a plan that's both balanced and bipartisan. I also think you'll hear him talk about the differences between cutting spending and reducing the deficit. The White House argument is that the Ryan plan cuts spending, but because of its big tax breaks for the wealthy, it doesn't achieve much actual deficit reduction or enough deficit reduction.
Well, Republicans are already attacking Mr. Obama for raising taxes as a way to bring down or cut the deficit. But what do you expect the reaction will be from the president's Democrats in Congress?
Well, Renee, already outside liberal groups like MoveOn.org are warning that if he touches entitlements, they will sit out the next election. Donors won't give to him anymore. But I think the real tripwire for a progressive Democratic revolt inside of Congress would be Social Security. It isn't a big driver of the deficit, although it does need to be put on a more solvent footing for future generations. But Paul Ryan left Social Security out of his plan, and I think today you'll hear generalities, not specifics, about Social Security from the president. But one important sign: yesterday, the ranking Democrat on the House Budget Committee, Chris Van Hollen, endorsed the Bowles-Simpson approach. So I think it looks like the president's own deficit commission is now shaping up to be the center of this debate.
Mara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Mara Liasson.
Congress has not quite finished a short-term budget deal for this fiscal year. Last Friday, Congress averted a government shutdown by reaching an agreement and also gave themselves a few extra days to finish work. But some voted against even those few extra days. The no votes included South Carolina Republican Tim Scott, elected last fall with Tea Party support. He says he is not sure yet if the deal that cuts $38 billion in spending goes far enough.
When you're asking for $61 billion, you end up around $38 billion. You certainly have received more than half of what you asked for. But when you are running $1.6 trillion deficits on an annual basis, it's hard to see $38 billion as a good starting place.
Did you have any sympathy for the argument of those who said, look, dealing with the deficit is a multi-year problem. You have to do it carefully. You have to do it relatively gradually, because if you don't, you could easily wreck the economy?
I certainly think that there's some truth and some logic in the fact that you can't do anything overnight that wasn't created overnight. So there's no question that we are going to have to take a methodical approach to solving our problems as a nation. But we must start somewhere, and we have to have a meaningful start.
Congressman, I want to play you a piece of tape, if I might. Presidential Advisor David Plouffe was on a Sunday talk show over the weekend, and he was talking about the budget battles to come. Of course, this was really just a prelude for much larger budget battles down the road, and this was Plouffe's approach to those budget battles.
The president said, listen, we can't take a machete. We have to take a scalpel. And we're going to have to cut, so we're going to have to look carefully. What you have to do is go line by line, a careful approach to this, so that we can cut spending, we can reduce the deficit in the short and long term, but without jeopardizing our economic growth and without jeopardizing those things like education and innovation.
He says use a scalpel, not a machete. Do you agree?
I would simply say that we must be careful and considerate with the spending cuts that we decide upon. But the real question is, can we continue to ascribe benefits and entitlements to ourselves today at the risk of eliminating those same benefits and entitlements to the next generation of Americans? My answer is no. So whether people see that as an incision used with a scalpel or whether you use a butter knife, it's going to be painful either way. I don't think that there's a machete in the conversation because there's nothing draconian about going back to 2008 or 2006 levels. So if you can't survive on 95% or 90% of your income, you are way overspending.
One or two other things. One has to do with the fact that Planned Parenthood ended up being in the debate at the end of last week. And there was disagreement over exactly how, but there certainly was language that was proposed that would have eliminated funding for Planned Parenthood, and that became a major sticking point. Do you think it is appropriate for social issues or other kinds of issues to be involved in this larger debate over the budget and the economy?
If they're spending $300+ million of taxpayer dollars, if it is a spending issue, all spending should be on the table. I mean, we're talking about military, we're talking about Planned Parenthood, we're talking about every other issue that comes to the table. If we can talk about police officers and firemen, why in the world would we not be able to talk about Planned Parenthood?
Well, I guess I was thinking about Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who's been on the program and who said in the past, he took a little heat for it, but spoke of a truce on certain social issues because he felt that there were fiscal issues that were more important. And Daniels has since asserted he's as conservative as anybody on the social issues, but he just felt it was a matter of priorities and of timing. Are there questions of priorities and timing that ought to be taken into consideration here?
That's the beauty of this great nation and even our Republican Party, is that we can have people who have differing opinions and still get along just fine. So ultimately, what I've said is what I will continue to say, that every spending issue should be on the table with no exceptions.
And one other thing, Congressman.
Yes, sir.
Because you did vote no on this resolution, which kept the government open for several more days so that the agreement, the budget agreement, could be finalized and voted on. Of course, if everyone had voted no, or if a majority had voted no, the government would be shut down right now. Is it your view that the problem with the deficit is so urgent that it might actually be helpful to the country, or at least worth it to the country, to have a train wreck at some point?
The goal has never been to shut the government down. The goal is always to cut spending. So anyone who wants to have a conversation about cutting spending should come to the table.
But you did, in effect, vote for that train wreck last Friday.
Well, I voted for us to continue to take a look at how do we cut spending based on governing and leading, not on politicizing the issue of shutting the government down.
Congressman Tim Scott, thanks very much for your time.
Yes, sir. You have a great day.
When President Obama speaks today about the country's long-term debt, he'll be offering an alternative to the 2012 budget that House Republicans introduced last week. The GOP plan calls for big tax cuts and a major overhaul of Medicare for future retirees. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on what the government's own workforce shows about how the Republican plan might work.
The GOP budget would leave Medicare as is for people 55 and older, but younger workers would get a different deal when they hit retirement age. Instead of relying on the government to simply pay their medical bills, these workers would get a government subsidy, which Republican Congressman Paul Ryan says they could use to shop around for private health insurance.
What we want to do with health care is apply those free market principles: choice, competition, transparency, and price and quality. That, to me, is the way to reform health care.
Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee, is counting on choice and competition to rein in spiraling health care costs. And he didn't have to look far to find a model for his proposed insurance marketplace.
This plan is identical to the system that members of Congress and other federal employees enjoy today.
Indeed, some 8 million federal employees, retirees, and family members get their health insurance this way. The government pays about 70% of their premiums, and employees are free to shop around from a wide variety of insurance offerings. So, how is this plan done at controlling health care costs? Over the last two decades, costs in this competitive market have risen faster than in Medicare itself, an average increase of nearly 7% each year.
So when Congressman Ryan thinks private insurers, through their competition, will lower total healthcare expenditure, he must be dreaming. There is zero evidence that that will work.
Princeton economist Uwe Reinhardt says shopping for healthcare is not like shopping for other goods. Prices are rarely posted. Quality is hard for the layperson to judge. And far from controlling costs, competition among private insurers tends to drive costs up.
The more insurance carriers you have competing with one another, the weaker each of them will be in bargaining with the hospitals. If I were a hospital executive or a large medical group, I would just pray that there be lots and lots of insurance companies, because then if they want to bargain with me and I don't like the price that they offer to pay, I say, take a walk, I can do without you.
That also poses a challenge for President Obama's health care reform, which relies on a similar market of private insurers to lower costs for individuals and small businesses. In Ryan's plan, the government subsidies for insurance would rise only as fast as inflation. So if insurance premiums keep going up faster, seniors would end up shouldering more and more of the cost themselves. Tax policy expert Bill Gale of the Brookings Institution says Ryan needs to keep a tight lid on the government's health care bills because he's also calling for big tax cuts.
Basically, what Ryan's doing is saying, we're going to make the Bush tax cuts permanent, and because of that, we're going to have much steeper cuts in Medicare and Medicaid than we otherwise would need to.
But if Ryan's plan relies on unduly rosy assumptions about the future of Medicare, economist Reinhardt says it still serves a useful purpose.
I view the Ryan budget like a 2x4 that smacks us in the face and wakes us up and say, we need to have a debate on how to deal with healthcare costs and how to deal with our fiscal deficit.
The president weighs in with his own plan later today. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.